Okay, so we're going to keep going on our description of hypersurfaces, but sort of in a strange detour, what I'm going to do first in this lecture is to talk about how to do space-time integrals. And the idea is that I'm going to basically bring it down from four-dimensional space-time to the three-dimensional hypersurface using very similar techniques, and then we'll even bring it down to two-dimensional surfaces again, in a sort of unified manner. And for that, I have to start at the beginning. So what do we mean by integration? Well, typically what we would have is a four-dimensional region in space-time, some bounded region V. And we would want to define something like an integral, which means over the domain V, we would take a scalar function and integrate it over a volume element. And I think we all know that the volume element that we use in space-time is constructed from the space-time metric, the metric determinant under a square root like this. And then we would have the usual, collection of coordinate increments that we would all join together in a volume element. Lots of things that could be said about where that comes from, but I'll take it that you know where that comes from. But there are various levels of this. And you're going to see a hint of where this is coming from perhaps a slightly more fundamental level, but I'm going to just hint at that. I'm not going to face this directly. And what I mean by facing this directly is that, well, you know, the mathematical theory that's behind integration on a manifold is the theory of differential forms. And what I'm going to do for the next few minutes is to do forms without doing forms. The forms are going to be there, but it's going to be, in somewhat disguised form. All right, so we can always define an integral like this when we're dealing with scalar functions. If you were tempted to define an integral like this, where this would be a vector or some kind of tensor, those things don't exist. So it's only when, so we can only integrate a scalar function over a space-time region, but we'll be able to integrate a vector over a space-like hypersurface, and we'll be able to integrate a tensor, antisymmetric tensor, over a two-dimensional surface. So, if we attempted to define something like this with a vector instead of a scalar function, the problem is that the result would not be itself a vector. It would be, it would not change appropriately under a change in coordinates, and that would mean that the operation is not well defined as a tensorial expression. Okay, so the idea is that I want to look at this right-hand side here, but I want to reintroduce it in a rather strange way. And what I'll introduce here is an object called, it can be called two different ways. It's either the Levi-Civita tensor, if you're in mostly in the context of older tensor calculus, literature, or in more modern incarnations of this, it's also known as the volume form. And what I'm defining here is a tensor that is a proper space-time tensor in the sense that it would have all the right properties under coordinate transformations. View it like that. It's a completely antisymmetric tensor, so that's why it's a form, it's a four form. Completely antisymmetric under an exchange of any index here. And what is it really? Well, it's formed from the metric determinant, and it's formed from the permutation symbol that usually would be denoted epsilon, but I want to distinguish the notation between this and that. So the permutation symbol I'll just write as a bracket like this. And the notation is meant to suggest that it's not supposed to be thought of as a tensor. That's a tensor. This is a strange object with respect to tensor calculus. And this is definitely a non-tensor, but when we combine this and that, we do get a tensor. So what is this? So let me just say that this is a tensor, proper tensor. This is the metric determinant under square root, as we've encountered before. And that's the permutation symbol. And what this means is that, well, this is going to be equal to plus one if we have an even permutation of 0, 1, 2, 3. And it's going to be minus 1 if we're dealing with a knot permutation of 0, 1, 2, 3. And it's going to be 0 if we have two or more identical indices, if any two index are the same. So that's an object that we often encounter in three-dimensional calculus. We would call it, you know, we would denote it epsilon. Typically, in the three-dimensional version of this, it would have three indices. And that's the thing that's defined exactly in those terms, except that there would be three indices, or three, you know, three members of the list instead of four in this case. So just to make this clear, you know, if I'm writing it like this, then that's obviously an even permutation of 0, 1, 2, 3, so it would be plus 1. If I interchange, I don't know, I'll pick a random order here, 1, 3, 2, 0. If I write it like this, well, the idea is that you have to swap, you know, indices, you know, a number of ways in order to reproduce the canonical order, and the number of swaps will dictate whether it's an even or odd permutation. So if we do that, let's see if we can do it. So I want to bring 0 over here, so I'll swap the 1 and the 0. And that brings a minus sign because it's, you know, for we get a minus sign for each swap that we do. And then, okay, I have the 0 in the right place, but the 1 is in the wrong place. So I'm going to swap the 1 into 3, and I'm getting another another minus sign. So now it becomes plus. And what I see here is that what I had here was an even permutation of this, and therefore I get plus 1. So you can, you know, you can play the game like this, and, you know, after swapping indices and reproducing the initial order, you'll get either plus 1 or minus 1. And the idea is that, you know, because it's a permutation symbol, every time we swap indices like this, we get a minus sign, and then it's a matter of deciding if you had an even number of swaps or an odd number. All right, so that object is, well, something you've probably encountered before. The way that it's used is actually to calculate the determinant of a matrix. Even though you may not have seen it presented like this, well, that's a way of introducing this. So I'll just, you know, I'll just claim, I won't prove this, but I'll claim that the permutation symbol is something that you would naturally use in the computation of the determinant. So if we have a matrix M alpha beta, so here I'm thinking of this as just a matrix. It doesn't necessarily have to be a tensor, but it's a 4x4 matrix defined in a four-dimensional space-time. Then if I want to calculate the determinant of that matrix, then the operation you would actually carry out corresponds to this. Let me make sure I write it out in the right way. So you would write it like this. M alpha 0, M beta 1, M gamma 2, M delta 3. So I'm just parachuting this. You've probably never encountered that before. But what I promise you is that this is exactly the same computation that you would do if you were to organize the matrix elements in that usual construction that we do to calculate determinants. You would, you know, you would list M00, M01, M02, M03. Then you would keep going like this. And then, you know, to compute this huge determinant, you would do the usual, you know, row and column elimination. And you would start here, you would, you know, isolate this, you would construct the determinant corresponding to that. Then you would switch over here. Switching over here would introduce a minus sign. Switching over here would introduce another minus sign. So you do all of those things. And what I claim is that all of this sign switching that you do when you compute subdeterminants from the big one is exactly what's dictated to you by the use of the permutation symbol. So all I can do here, I'm not going to, you know, prove this because it would require a very long computation to make sure that that the outcomes match. But you know, that's the kind of thing that you can justify for yourself starting in 2D, do a 2x2 matrix and show that something involving a two-dimensional permutation symbol and doing something like this in 2D gives you the right value for the determinant. You can do it in 3D. And then after that, you can sort of see the pattern of the calculation. And unless you're really keen, you probably don't have to work it out in 4D. But anyway, so what I wanted to say here is that while the permutation symbol like this, which is decidedly not a tensor, is something that allows you to calculate the determinant of any matrix, and in particular the matrix, the matrix could be a tensor, and that would be a way by which, the permutation symbol could be introduced in computations. And, with that knowledge, then it's not too surprising that the metric determinant here and the permutation symbol should sort of come together in some kind of way, because we're basically talking about determinants when we're talking about the permutation symbol. Okay, so that's my way of introducing the permutation symbol. And then once we have that, then we have a tensor, a proper tensor that we get after multiplying by the square root of the metric determinant. So I'm not going to prove any of this, but you can take my word that this is a tensor, and that's something that can be involved in calculation of volume elements, either in 4D, 3D, 2D, blah, blah, blah. That's the sort of starting point of those constructions. Okay. So let me do a side calculation first, and then I'll come back to this notion of defining a volume element. So suppose that we do a coordinate transformation. And we're going to go from an original system of coordinates to a new one. So let's say from x alpha to z mu. And then a standard exercise in tensor calculus is to relate all the tensors together under coordinate transformation like this. And we know that the metric will transform in the way that we expect. And the two metrics are going to be related by an equation like this, where we basically include all the partial derivatives in the transformation law. So that's standard, but if we go from that equation to one for the metric determinant, then the determinant of the metric in the z-coordinates is going to be related to the metric determinant in the x-coordinates times the determinant of the coordinate transformation squared. And of course, the determinant of the coordinate transformation is what we call the Jacobian, right? So if we turn that into an equation, we have that the two metric determinants are going to be related by an equation like this, where we have the determinant of the coordinate transformation that we square in that equation. And that's simply that, determinants of products of matrices are just products of determinants. All right, so all of this to show that if we take a square root and we say that the volume element in the z-coordinates is going to be related to the volume element in the x-coordinate by a factor of the Jacobian, and the Jacobian is, again, just this determinant that we get from all the partial derivatives. Okay. So all of this is to show that the volume element in z-coordinates, which is going to be the metric determinant in the z-coordinates times all the z-things, well, that's going to be related to the volume element in the x-coordinates by a Jacobian. So so that's going to be the same thing as metric determinant And that's the same thing as, sorry. So according to this result here, we have the Jacobian determinant that we insert here. And this is the thing that relates the pure coordinate measures of volume. And that means that the volume element that I defined here is actually invariant under a coordinate transformation. All right. So anyway, so I think all of this you probably have encountered before. And that's why this expression, you know, up there for the volume element arises. Basically, the square root of the metric in the definition of the volume element is the thing that compensates for the appearance of a Jacobian determinant when you actually do the coordinate transformation, and you end up with a volume element that turns out to be invariant under coordinate transformation. Okay, so now I'm going to do something strange. So I'm going to do, well, let me just say it. So we want to integrate using the new coordinates. So what I would want to do here is to actually use the volume element as provided to us by the metric in the z-coordinates with the, collection of coordinate increments like this that we would collect together like this. So we want to use those z-coordinates to do the integral. For some reason, maybe the x-coordinates that we started with are not adequate to do the job, or they're more complicated than they need to be given the boundary that, the shape of the domain over which we want to integrate. Regardless, I just want to consider that question. And I'm going to do something very strange. I'm going to consider something, the type of maneuver that you often see in textbooks, consider something. Why should I consider that? Well, because I know that's the answer I want in the end. Other than that, there's no reason to consider it, but I'll ask you to consider it regardless. So consider. I'm going to consider this very strange looking expression. So I'm going to take my volume form, which contains the metric determinant, but in the x coordinates, because this is all formulated in the x alpha coordinates. But what I'm going to do then is to, again, let me check my notes, make sure I'm not making a mistake here. Right, I'm going to take partial derivatives with respect to z0, z1, z2, and z3 like that. And I'm going to multiply by dz0, dz1, dz2, dz3. So, very strange object. But I want to prove that this is, in fact, the volume element that I'm talking about. So it's a very strange way of writing out a volume element, but we're going to see why, that turns out to be useful when it's time to bring this down from 4D to 3D to do this on a hypersurface. Okay, so consider this. So why should we ever consider that? Well, the answer is that we're going to compute what it is, and we're going to recognize it as the volume element in z-coordinates. So what is this? Well, this is, first of all, the metric determinant in x-coordinates, because the tensor here is written in terms of the original system, x-alpha. And it's the permutation symbol. And that multiplies a very specific matrix, the matrix of partial derivatives. And then we have the d's at 0, d's at 1, d's at 2, d's at 3. And well, this is, you know, over here, something we'll recognize, given what I told you before, as the determinant of that matrix that I'm defining here, the matrix of all partial derivatives. So this, by, you know, the sort of claim that I made before, is nothing but the determinant of all the partial derivatives. And therefore, it's the Jacobian. Same Jacobian factor that we encountered before. So what do we have in the end? Well, we have the square root of the metric determinant in the x-coordinates. We have the Jacobian matrix, or the Jacobian determinant. And we have the coordinate increments. And finally, this combination here is, by the computation I just did before, well, that's simply the metric determinant in the z-coordinate, under the square root, as always. So sure enough, that strange construction that I started with is the invariant volume element in z-coordinates. So it's the volume element because, you know, it's a coordinate invariant. Therefore, I don't need to specify after the fact whether we're integrating in z-coordinates or integrating in x-coordinates. That construction over here gives me the correct volume element. So a very sort of roundabout way of defining a volume element would have been to start here and demonstrate that it behaves appropriately under coordinate transformations, that it's in fact a volume element that can be defined in any coordinate system. So the reason why I started there, which I agree is convoluted and not terribly natural and very strange and completely parachuted, is that, well, what I'm going to do next is to think about how we can adapt this construction to a situation where we're not integrating over all of space-time, but we're integrating over a hypersurface. And the idea is that when we're doing this over a hypersurface, we're going to have three coordinates that are intrinsic to the hypersurface, and we're going to be missing that zeroth one. So we're going to be able to change this construction to eliminate that first, and that will give us a notion of a volume element that has one index attached to it, and that's going to be a directed surface element that will turn out to point in the normal direction of the hypersurface. So we're going to see coming out, so that type of volume element that you've encountered before, will come out of this construction properly adapted to 3D from 4D. All right. If I were to do this and say that, well, in fact, if I were to consider a limiting case where the z-coordinates are, in fact, the same thing as the x-coordinates, then what would I have? Well, I would have the partial derivative of x alpha with respect to x zero, and that would be zero, unless alpha is equal to zero. And similar story here. So in the sort of limiting case where the z-coordinates are exactly the same as the x-coordinate, then that strange construction that we started with as d4z. Well, in that situation, what we would have is a non-vanishing partial derivative only when alpha is equal to 0. So we get 0, 1, 2, 3. This would be a non-vanishing partial derivative only when beta is 1, when gamma is 2, when delta is 3. Otherwise, it's all 0. So out of performing this big sum over four indices, we would pick out only one term, the one with the tensor, the volume form, with this ordering of indices. And this, of course, is going to be the square root of the determinant with the permutation symbol evaluated to 1. So we would get, and this would become d4x, because the z-coordinates are identical to the z-coordinates. So the strange construction, if we make it trivial by not distinguishing between the two coordinate systems, then we do end up with the, you know, with the proper volume element. Not too surprisingly, but, you know, it had to be checked that the construction that I'm starting with here is something that can be used as a volume element regardless of the coordinate system, including the original one. All right, so bottom line is that with that strange, you know, quantity here, we have something that gives us a volume element in space-time. And the idea would be, well, try to see if we can adapt this to a three-dimensional situation if we're dealing with a hypersurface. And that's going to give us a clue on how to do it for two-dimensional surfaces. And in principle, we could go all the way down if we wanted to integrate on a curve, for example. Okay, so are we good? So it's a little bit roundabout. It's a little bit random. It's a little bit, you know, strange. But now that I hope this is, you know, established, we can really see what this gives when we go down in dimension. So are we all good with this here? Okay. Okay, so let's do this in 3D. Okay. So basically looking at integrating on a hypersurface. Okay, and just to motivate this a little bit, because, you know, we can rely on existing knowledge to start thinking about this. We can, you know, so we can rely back on what we learned in vector calculus back in our undergraduate days. So in vector calculus, the typical thing that we would do if we wanted to integrate over, so the analogous situation here is that we would have a three-dimensional space and we would want to integrate something on a two-dimensional surface. So we would have a two-dimensional surface, S, you know, doesn't have to be closed, but it could be closed. It could be bounding some kind of region V. And what we would want to do is to, on that surface, define a surface element that would now have a vectorial direction, the vectorial direction being the normal direction. So the usual thing here is that we would define an area element on that surface. We would combine it with the with the normal vector at that point on that surface, and we would define a surface element as the combination of the normal vector with the scalar area element. So the point of this is that, well, you know, going back in those days, we have already a notion that the volume element or the surface element inherited from the three-dimensional description when we apply it to a two-dimensional surface is something that should have a vector direction attached to it, the vector direction being the normal direction to the surface. So that, I think, we're pretty familiar. And the idea here is that as we go from 4D to 3D, we should probably end up in the same place where the, you know, what is now a surface element on a three-dimensional surface should have also a vector direction attached to it, and that vectorial direction should be the direction of the normal. So it wouldn't be, you know, surprising to end up there given, you know, what we know, or by analogy to what, you know, we used to do in the 3D goes to 2D version of this. So what I'm going to do here is to look at that strange construction over here and try to adapt it to the new situation where we would distinguish between the four-dimensional space-time coordinates x alpha and the ya coordinates that we would naturally place on the hypersurface. So in this new situation, we have, you know, the hypersurface that comes with ya coordinates embedded in a space-time described by x alpha coordinates. And the idea would be to try to define a notion of surface element on that surface. And, you know, if we go back to this, it's the observation that I made previously. We would be thinking of doing something similar to this, except that instead of going from x alpha coordinates to z mu coordinates, we would be thinking of going from X alpha coordinates to Y A coordinates. And the only difference is that for the Y A coordinates, I don't have four of them, I have three of them. So I can define those partial derivatives with respect to Y1, Y2, Y3, but that one doesn't have, you know, a meaning in this context. It doesn't exist because there's no Y0 coordinate. We have a three-dimensional system of coordinates on the hypersurface. So whatever happens, we can reconsider that construction without that factor added. And if we remove that factor, we leave a free alpha index, and that's going to be the vectorial nature of our surface element. So I'm going to ask you to consider again what I'm going to ask you to consider is a dimensionally reduced version of this, where we take out one of those partial derivatives because we don't have access to it, doesn't exist for us now. And because we lose that factor, we're ending up with, you know, that construction here specialized, you know, with a free alpha index, you know, left over. So we still have the four-dimensional volume form. Now we have a derivative of x beta with respect to y1, derivative of x gamma with respect to y2, derivative of x delta with respect to y3. So those partial derivatives are defined. We're summing over beta, gamma, and delta. We're left over with one free index alpha. And the construction gives us a covector. And the covector, I claim, is going to be the directed volume element or directed surface element on the hypersurface. So I'm going to define that to be d sigma alpha. So that's just notation. And this is what I'm saying is the, you know, the vector valued or covector valued, doesn't matter, volume element, or I should say surface element on sigma. And what I want to do is to, well, convince you of that. Convince you of that. We're going to stare at this a bit longer. We're going to try and show that it does exactly the right thing, and it's exactly what we would expect it to be, given what we can do simply looking at the YA coordinates and setting up a volume element using that. Right? So we're going to play with this and see if we can make sense of that. Okay, so let's dig in. So, okay, so the first thing to note here is that, well, maybe I didn't need the fancy construction to construct a volume element on the hypersurface. I already have everything that I need in the induced metric. If I have the induced metric, I can look at its determinant and I can define a volume element purely in those terms. So a much more, you know, convincing starting point to this whole business would be to say that, well, we do have a volume element, and the volume element would simply be the determinant, or, you know, here I'll say plus or minus the determinant. Well, let me put it like this, epsilon times the determinant of the induced metric, multiplying dy1, dy2, dy3. That would be, you know, the completely analogous thing that we can do in the three-dimensional submanifold that would mimic exactly what we did in space-time, and that, you know, would have all the right properties to describe a volume element, and there would be nothing wrong with, you know, using this. So we could have started here, and that would have been the end of the story. Well, maybe it's not quite the end of the story, because maybe we would have liked to turn this into a directed surface element with a vector, with a vector direction. And then it would be a natural thing to combine this with the normal vector, just in the same way we're used to doing it in 3D vector calculus. And maybe, you know, a much more convincing starting point for this whole discussion would have been to turn that into a directed surface element by adjoining this with the normal vector, and that would give us everything, presumably, that we would ever want for, you know, a normal directed surface element. So that would be a directed surface element. And this would be an undirected surface element. So why not starting here, and why not leave it at that instead of doing that strange thing that I did previously? Well, there are lots of, you know, reasons behind this. And the reason why we could do both is because they're basically equivalent. In fact, we're going to show that up to a factor of epsilon, that thing we're constructing here is exactly that thing here. So in spite of the strangeness, we're really talking about the same thing. The reason why we don't want this to be the end of the story is because at some point we're going to want to make the move to a null surface, null hypersurface. And the thing with a null hypersurface is that, well, there's no notion of a unit normal. There's no notion of something like this that would describe a purely, you know, undirected, surface element, because one of those directions is null. The direction along the null cones, along the null geodesics of the null cone, is null. Therefore, ds squared for that direction is zero. And that would mean that the construction completely breaks down in the null case. So that would be very difficult to generalize in the null case, whereas this doesn't require any adjustment. That construction applies for any type of surface. We don't have to change anything. And in particular, we can just adopt this in the null case without having to change anything. So that's really the reason why I wanted to, you know, do this strange business, because I know that this is something that gives me a much better starting point to discuss volume elements on a null hypersurface, in spite of the fact that it looks very unfamiliar and very strange, and certainly not nearly as intuitive as that. But of course, fortunately, we can show that, you know, in this case of space-like or time-like, that construction reduces to that apart from a factor of epsilon. And that's something that's easy to do, especially when you have access to Gaussian coordinates. So that's why I introduced Gaussian coordinates. That was part of the, you know, part of the motivation, is because I can do the calculation in those coordinates and we can establish the equality between this and that. So basically, this is more fundamental, a starting point to describe directed surface elements on the 3D surface. And now that we know how to reduce it down from 4D to 3D, it's not going to take too much effort to figure out how to reduce it down even further to 2D. We just, you know, lose another one of those factors and end up with a directed surface element that has two indices left free instead of just the one here. And then, you know, you can even go beyond that and define a surface element on the line that would have three spatial indices, three space-time indices, you know, attached to it. All right. So what I want to do now is to just prove that this unintuitive thing is really the same thing as that, except for a factor of epsilon. And therefore, after proving this, we can rely on this easier way of looking at it, which basically is much more natural and certainly much more, plausible than that over here. But, you know, again, the motivation for starting here is just to provide a more unified description of volume elements that can include the null case, which otherwise would be inaccessible if we started here instead. Okay, so what I want to prove is that the official volume element that we introduced up here through that construction, that's epsilon times n alpha d sigma. And that's the kind of thing that would be, you know, somewhat laborious to prove in a general coordinate system. But here we're going to apply my general principle, which is to say, let's, you know, work in coordinates that are well suited to what we're trying to do here. And what we're going to prove is the equality of a vector to another vector in one very specific coordinate system. And if we can establish equality in one very specific coordinate system, well, because this is a vector and this is a vector, we have equality in all coordinate systems. So that's always the payoff here. So one coordinate system that's well adapted to a given calculation, if it allows you to establish equality between tensor and tensor, that means that you have equality in all coordinate systems, because both sides of the equation will transform in the same way under an arbitrary coordinate transformation. So the strategy is to basically look at this in Gaussian coordinates, and show that they're the same, and that proves it once and for all. And just to make the point, here we are talking about a vector or a covector, because this is a proper tensor that's been sort of reduced down to one single index. So if this is a proper tensor, then the one left over after you've contracted with the three indices here, that has to be a proper vector. Okay, so now I think what I've said is longer. So I think my discussion is longer than the calculation will end up being. So we're reintroducing our Gaussian coordinates. So remember the construction. We have the YA coordinates that are going to be promoted to a neighborhood of the surface. And we're going to carry them away from the surface using those orthogonal geodesics. So in our Gaussian system, we have the collection of YAs and L. That's going to be our coordinate system. And in those coordinates, we have that N alpha is 1, 0, 0. We have that N alpha with index down is a factor of epsilon, 0, 0, 0. And then we have that all the other vectors are just very simple ones and zeros. So we have a whole bunch like that.
Okay.
Yep.
I don't think the Zoom people can see that.
Oh, right. I'm on the wrong side of the. Yeah. I don't know if I have anyone on Zoom.
Yeah.
We are able to see it this time.
Oh, good. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, we are.
That helps me. Thank you. Okay, so we had that before, and we also had the fact that the square root of the metric determinant in that coordinate system was the same thing as minus epsilon h, that's something else. So that's something that's valid on the hypersurface itself. So all stuff that we worked out previously this morning. Where am I? Right, okay. So let's calculate both sides and show that they're equal. So on the left, we have d sigma alpha, which is properly defined in terms of the volume form and all of those partial derivatives. So I'll just replace those partial derivatives by the set of tangent vectors. So it's E beta 1, E gamma 2, E delta 3. And what is that? Well, in any coordinate system, this is going to be the square root of the metric determinant, the permutation symbol, and E beta 1, E gamma 2, E delta 3. And in the Gaussian coordinates, well, those are zeros and ones. So this is going to be non-zero only when beta is equal to 1. So that will force this beta to be equal to 1. This will force this gamma to be equal to 2. And this forces this delta to be equal to 3. So in Gaussian coordinates, and I'm going to now say that we're specializing with the star on top of the equality sign, I can replace the square root of the determinant by epsilon h, and now I have an epsilon beta gamma delta, where beta has been turned into a 1 after summation, gamma into 2, and delta into 3. And here I forgot the d3y that follows here. Okay. And, well, there's only one possible value that alpha can take after, you know, forcing those entries here to be 1, 2, 3. This has to be 0. So the only non-zero the only non-zero component of that equation is going to be where alpha, when alpha is equal to 0, and that's the L direction that we single out here. So I can just rewrite this as, and it's still in Gaussian coordinates, minus epsilon H times d4y d0 alpha, or, you know, being more explicit, it's the alpha has to be equal to L, otherwise the result is 0. All right, so that's the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, well, let's work out N alpha d sigma. So N alpha, well, in Gaussian coordinates, that's epsilon when alpha is equal to L. So we again have a factor of delta L alpha, and we have, so that vector on the right-hand side is also, also has a non-vanishing component only in the L direction. So that's this quantity over here, and this quantity over here, well, that's the usual volume element that we would get from the induced metric. So sorry, I think I was meant to put a minus sign here, because the right. So sorry about the confusion. So we're dealing with minus epsilon H, and that's the quantity that will give me. So if we're dealing with a time-like surface, space-like surface, let's start there. Then the vector n is time-like, therefore epsilon is minus 1. And in that case, we get h in the case of a space-like surface. And that's the right thing that we should have under the determinant. But if the surface is time-like, then the n vector is space-like, epsilon is plus 1, and we get minus h. So that's the correct, thing that we would have under the square root. So the point is that whatever, what's inside the square root has to be positive. In the space-like direction, for the space-like surface, HAB only has positive entries. But in the time-like direction, there's one entry for HAB that's negative, and therefore the determinant will be negative. And, that's why I need the minus sign here to get rid of that minus sign. So I was missing that minus in front of epsilon that makes sure that all the signs work out. It's always the, that's always the place where you spend most time worrying, where all the signs going, and, did I account for all the signs correctly? The rest is pretty trivial in comparison. Okay, so back to where we were. So to construct that volume element, so I've already accounted for the n vector over here, and now I'm looking at the rest of it, and what we have in the rest of it is the square root of minus h times epsilon, and we have d3y. And sure enough, the right-hand side is almost the same thing as the left-hand side, except for that extra factor of epsilon. So what do we have here? We have the statement that as established in Gaussian coordinates, we have that the volume element, as defined through the strange construction, is the same thing as the one you would normally, construct based on more elementary operations. And the only difference is that there's a factor of epsilon in front. And again, it's just a matter of sign, just to make sure that if you have, an n vector, just to make sure that the signs all work out. And it's a bit of a nuisance that in the time-like case, there's a minus sign here, so that if n is pointing to the future, that guy is pointing to the past. There's a lot of, hours that have been spent trying to sort out those signs in all sorts of calculations. But, the point is that it's all accounted for, and that's the relationship between the two things. And we have established the equality of two vectors in Gaussian coordinates. And by virtue of the, you know, the transformation properties of vectors, establishing equality in one coordinate system is the same as establishing equality under all coordinates, and therefore establishing equality between vectors. So bottom line is that at the end of the day, we can forget about the fact that we used Gaussian coordinates in this demonstration, because the conclusion is valid in all coordinate systems. It's an equality between vectors. So bottom line is, we started out with that strange thing that was inherited from the four-dimensional, equally strange thing. But we recognize after doing this little calculation that that construction is, you know, reproducing the more elementary notion of volume element that we would, you know, normally come up with, you know, if we wanted to define everything in terms of the induced metric on the hypersurface. And so the natural looking volume element combined with the normal vector gives us a very plausible and, you know, perfectly adequate notion of directed surface element. And the whole point is that apart from that factor of epsilon, it all comes from that construction. So this looks strange, but it does the job. And the main virtue is what I said previously, that it does the job also outside of the space-like and time-like case. It will do the job in the null case, something that would be very difficult to deal with if we only had this. Because as I said previously, there's no notion of unit normal to a null surface. That would break down because of the null direction. So the right-hand side completely breaks down, but the left-hand side continues to be perfectly well behaved, well defined, even for a null surface. So it's more, you know, in the end, it's a much more, you know, promising starting point to unify all, you know, all those types of hypersurfaces under one, you know, one description. All right, we're good with that? Okay, so let me go from here and briefly sketch what would need to be done in 2D if we wanted to go one more dimension down. I think you can see what, you know, what would come out, and I'll just write down a few things without providing any proofs, because it basically would be more of the same, and there's no need to spend time on that. So let's go from, so here I should have said 4D. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. So let's look at a 2D surface version of this. So here's the situation. So we started out in space-time, and we can define a hypersurface by going down in one dimension. I'll draw it as a, you know, as a space-like hypersurface. And then if we wanted, on that hypersurface, we could define a two-dimensional surface. Here I'm drawing it closed, it doesn't have to be closed, by basically going one more dimension down. So I could define a 2D surface, I'll call it S, and that's a 2D surface that's going to be defined in that three-dimensional, hypersurface. So I could start with this by basically doing it one step down to 3D, another step down to 2D. Or, well, I could just choose to go directly from 4D to 2D and just talk about that two-dimensional surface without necessarily thinking of it as being defined in a three-dimensional hypersurface. Doesn't really matter. I mean, it really doesn't matter how you do it. You don't have to adapt any of the constructions to reflect one scenario versus the other one. So I like to think about doing it this way because here we can, I hope, visualize things a little bit more easily. So one thing that changes now, so when we adapt the construction to one lower dimension, we're going to lose one of those coordinates because our two-dimensional surface is going to have, you know, here we only see one dimension, but it has two, you know, it's described by two coordinates that I'm calling theta A. Here I'm thinking of them as angular coordinates because I'm thinking of a closed surface, but the surface doesn't have to be closed. The hypersurface, you know, the coordinates don't have to be angular. But the point is that, you know, here we had three coordinates, and now on that surface we have two coordinates. So we're going to lose one of those factors, and we're going to get, you know, a volume, you know, or surface element that will now have two indices, you know, two free indices, and that's something that will give us, you know, a different structure. And, you know, in parallel to that, well, now we have a situation where we have two normal vectors to play with. And it's not going to be an accident that we have two free indices that will match the fact that we have two normal vectors to play with. So the first normal vector is the one that's, you know, attached to the hypersurface. So that's our good old N vector that we've talked about. So that vector is normal to the hypersurface, and it's still going to be normal to that two-dimensional surface S. But now we have one more normal, which would be the, you know, I'll call it the R vector, the one that is defined in the hypersurface, normal to S, but still tangent to the hypersurface sigma. So we have two normals, the one that's time-like, well, I'm not going to presume the signature here. We have two normals, one that I'm calling N alpha, that's orthogonal to the hypersurface sigma, and the R vector, which is normal to S, but still tangent to sigma. So this is normal to sigma, and this is normal to S, but in sigma. So two normals, you know, one pointing in the time direction, the other one, say, pointing in one of the spatial directions. And, you know, we can assign an epsilon to N, as we did before. It's still going to be the same epsilon. And then for R, we also have an epsilon, because if N is time-like and epsilon is minus 1, then this one is going to be space-like, and the right-hand side is going to be plus 1. So whatever sign we choose here, we have to choose the opposite sign here. All right. So the surface element will now be something that has two free indices attached to them. And it's going to be basically the obvious thing that we would get. We would get dx alpha differentiated to with respect to one of the intrinsic coordinates, and dx delta differentiated with respect to the second. I think in the notes I used 2 and 3. Just to avoid being confused with a count. And, you know, it's basically exactly the same construction, but now, you know, recognizing that we've lost another one of those factors. And therefore, we have two free indices and two indices that are being summed over with the remaining two partial derivatives. That tensor here is fully antisymmetric, and that means that, you know, in particular, it means that a switch of alpha and beta changes the sign. So that's antisymmetric in alpha and beta. So we have a two-index thing that's antisymmetric. And it's pretty clear, or at least it's, you know, it's a good expectation that that thing here will turn out to be proportional to a product of the two normal vectors. But it's got to be an anti-symmetric product of those two normal vectors to respect the anti-symmetry. And it's got to be proportional to the normal vectors because it cannot be tangent, because if we were to multiply this with one occurrence of one of the tangent vectors, we would basically forcing the product to be zero. So it's got to be proportional to an antisymmetric product of N alpha and R beta. And I'll just tell you what the answer is. The proof would be very similar, and I have it in the posted notes. And the proof would be based on basically building a Gaussian coordinate system that's, you know, that you know, that would be centered around that surface here. So it would be a sort of, you know, doubly Gaussian, you know, system of coordinates, and basically doing very similar things to what we did in the 3D case. So I'll leave that for you to explore on your own. But I'll tell you what the answer is. The answer is that the volume element here is equal to R alpha n beta minus n alpha r beta. So it's an anti-symmetrized product of the two normal vectors times the usual surface element that you would normally assign to a dimensional surface in terms of the induced metric that would be defined purely on that two-dimensional surface. So ds would be the same thing as the square root of the determinant of the induced metric, let's call it GAB, times 2 d2 theta. So that would be the induced metric in theta A coordinates. And that would be defined, you know, as usual in terms of the tangent vectors that are purely tangent to S and the space-time metric. So it would be induced either from the three-dimensional metric on sigma or from the four-dimensional metric in space-time. So basically, the idea here is that, you know, we have a systematic way to go from 4D to 3D to 2D. We just adapt the construction. And in all cases, we can prove that the construction that we get, which is, you know, something that we inherit from the, you know, reduction in dimensionality, is something that we can associate to more plausible or more intuitive notion of surface elements that you would get from purely, you know, induced quantities like the induced metric on the surface and, you know, and things like that. So it all works, even though it's strange, it all works. And, you know, it allows us to unify all of those measures of integration, you know, in all space-time dimensions going down from 4D all the way down. We could even do one more step and do an integration on a curve by just getting rid of even one of those factors. And now we would have a three-index thing that would describe the line element along a curve defined in a four-dimensional space. But, you know, I think that's enough. I don't think we need to belabor that. I don't think we need to go to the next step to see how it would work out and, you know, how it can be done in a very systematic way. So that's basically doing forms without doing forms. So it all starts from the theory of differential forms presented in a way where we pretend we don't know about it, or, you know, presented in a way where you don't really need to know about it. But, you know, there's no denying that because the starting point was a completely antisymmetric tensor with four indices, that we are talking about four forms in a four-dimensional space-time. And, you know, the form structure is really underlying all of this. But, you know, I'm pretending that we don't know about that. Okay, so any questions about this? All right, so let me do a couple of more things and take advantage of all this beautiful stuff that we now have at our disposal. And I'm going to talk about Gauss's theorem and Stokes's theorem, so things that are familiar from 3D vector calculus, but things that can be adapted to you know, all of this space-time stuff. All right, so let's talk about two integral theorems that are very, very important. Right, so you know Gauss's theorem in 3D vector calculus, so the volume integral of a divergence is equal to the surface integral of the vector, so you've all seen this before. You know, the space-time version of this is just exactly the same words, but now lifted up in one dimension. So we're talking about the divergence of a vector field in four-dimensional space-time being equated to the surface integral of that vector field. So here it goes. So we have some kind of four-dimensional region in space-time bounded by a two-dimensional, three-dimensional hypersurface. So V is a 4D region in space-time. And sigma is the boundary. So that's typical notation for the boundary of a region, delta V. So that's the boundary of V. And it's, of course, a hypersurface. It's a closed hypersurface. And if we're working in space-time, then, of course, we're going to have space-like segments. We're going to have time-like segments, space-like segments, time-like segments. So the, you know, the nature of the hypersurface depends on where we are around that region. And what we're given also is a vector field. So that's an arbitrary vector field that has to be, you know, differentiable, blah, blah, blah. All the fine print that you need in the mathematical version of this. And what the theorem states is that the volume integral of the divergence of the vector field, and that's a scalar quantity, so that we're allowed to integrate, that's going to be equal to the closed hypersurface integral of the vector field on the boundary. So if you know about forms, there's a very nice way of writing this out in terms of exterior derivatives and things like that. But, you know, that's the more pedestrian version of this, which I think is, you know, as sort of plausible as it is in 3D vector calculus. It's just basically, lifted up one dimension. We're integrating over a four-dimensional region, and the boundary is now three-dimensional. So other than that, it's exactly the same thing, but of course formulated in terms of covariant derivatives and formulated in terms of surface elements that are naturally, you know, constructed as we have seen before. So the proof of this, I don't think I'm going to go through a proof here because, well, I think it's getting late in the day for that. But I'll just say two things about the nature of the proof. You can prove this exactly as you would in elementary 3D vector calculus. And the way this is done in 3D vector calculus is that you take your volume here and you basically split it up in terms of all bunch of little cubes and you fill up the space like this. And then you show that the theorem is valid for any one of those cubes. And that's easy because each cube is infinitesimal, so you can quickly, you know, differentiate and then integrate, and you end up with boundary terms. And then you just show that when you add up all the contributions from all the cubes, all the internal faces cancel out because the unit normal, you know, faces one way and then faces the other way. And by after summing all the cubes, you end up with an equality that involves the vector field purely on the boundary because all the contributions from all the internal faces here have disappeared. So that's the traditional proof. And you can just go through that and mimic this step by step in the four-dimensional version. And it follows in exactly the same way. So same proof as basically as in the more elementary 3D context. That would be the hard way of proving the result and the very straightforward but very pedestrian way of doing it. in the book and in the notes, I offer an alternative proof that again sort of takes advantage of designing a coordinate system that allows you to describe this in the best possible way, and of obtaining a proof that is very direct and very clever, almost too clever for its own good. And the proof takes about 3 or 4 lines of calculation, and all the calculations are very simple. So I'm not going to present any version of the proof here. I'll just say that, well, you can find it in what I've posted and in the book, and you can reflect on this and consider the two different types of proofs that you can provide and see what you like best. I think you'll learn something from doing that. But, you know, because the result is so plausible and because it looks almost identical to the elementary 3D version of this, I don't think we need to go too much into proving the result. I think we can be comfortable with that. We're going to see what we're going to do with this. The reason why, I don't need to tell you that Gauss's theorem is used all over the place. And in GR, it can be used mostly in the formulation of conservation statements. And that's something I'll come back to next time. I don't think I'll have time today. So let me do the Stokes version of this. And I think then we'll leave it at that for the day. So that was Gauss's theorem, and we have a Stokes theorem. So in 3D vector calculus, the Stokes theorem is about taking the curl of a vector field, integrating over a surface, and then that's related to the line integral of the vector field on the boundary. So what we have to do now is to lift this up one dimension the same way we did here. So it's going to be something that will look like a curl, but it's not quite going to be a curl, but something that will have that kind of flavor. All right, so let me start with a hypersurface. So that's a hypersurface. And on that I want to lift it up from a surface to a hypersurface, and I want to lift the line integral to a surface integral. So that's how we're going to do it. So the starting point here is going to be some bounded hypersurface that's going to be bounded by a two-dimensional surface. All right. So sigma is going to be a hypersurface, 3D hypersurface, and S is going to be the boundary of that hypersurface. So something that I could denote like the boundary of sigma. So here we go from 3D. Down to 2D, and for the sort of traditional version of Stokes' theorem, it would be going from 2D to 1D. So what can we do here? Well, so what we're going to need to formulate the theorem is going to be a tensor field. You're going to see why in a moment. And that tensor field is very important, has to be antisymmetric. So it has to be an antisymmetric. Tensor field. And I'll just tell you what the theorem states. The theorem states that the hypersurface integral of the divergence of that tensor field, let me make sure that I have my indices sorted out. So So I'm integrating over a hypersurface. So of course, I need the normal directed surface element to be involved here. That leaves me with one possible free index alpha. And I'm going to get that by taking the divergence of my B alpha beta tensor. And because I'm taking the divergence of an antisymmetric tensor, that's the kind of thing that has the flavor of a curl. It's not a curl because the curl doesn't exist in four-dimensional spacetime. But it's being replaced by, you know, the next best thing. So it sort of has the flavor of a curl. But of course, we're not integrating the curl over a two-dimensional surface. We're integrating the divergence of an antisymmetric tensor field over a hypersurface. But what does that give us? Well, there's a factor of 1/2 here. But other than that, it gives us the surface integral of the tensor field. So it's going to be an integral over S of the antisymmetric tensor field integrated over the surface with the appropriate surface element that, as we saw, is an antisymmetric tensor field itself. So that's the statement of Stokes' theorem. And you could prove it in a sort of the familiar ways of, you know, vector calculus, where again you would, you know, break this up into little tiles, and you would, you know, prove the theorem for one of those tiles, and then you would put all the tiles together, verify that all the internal faces cancel out, and you end up with, you know, and then contribution to the full surface integral in terms of the tensor field on the boundary. So you could do it like this, or you could adapt a clever proof that I'm not going to give you here, but you can find in the book or in the posted notes. And again, use the, you know, cleverness of choosing the coordinate system in the right way to perform this calculation. And, you know, you would end up with a very nice proof of this. So that's another important, you know, integral theorem of differential geometry, and something that we will use in later calculations. So even, you know, even though I'm not proving it here, I think it's something that will be used later on. So you probably want to invest a little bit of time looking into that, especially looking at the clever proof, because I think it's very clever and, you know, very worthwhile to go into. But I'm not going to supply those steps here. But I'll just warn you that we'll encounter that later on. And that's something that will play a role in our discussion on black holes. So I'm not sure if we'll really deal with that one, but it could be now, I forget. But I know for sure that we'll be dealing with that one, and we'll be doing something something very useful with that. So what to say? Okay, so I think I don't need to say any more. I'll ask you in a minute if you have questions. So there was a lot of formal stuff here, but all of that was really necessary in order to have, you know, a discussion of hypersurfaces that allows us to handle the null case. So that's going to be very important for the discussion of event horizons, as I said. So we really needed to do that. The integral theorems, at least this one, will come back later. So we'll need that. And what I need to do, and I'll do that next week to wrap up this whole thing, was to look at least another example, because I think all of this was pretty dry and we didn't do anything beyond, you know, looking at the sphere example. So I think we need to consolidate this with a more complicated example, or more complete example. So we'll do that next time. And I think I'll look at this a little bit more and just illustrate how it can lead to a conservation statement, conservation of charge if we have a conserved current density. I think those are important notions that that we need to discuss, because that's the big payoff of the Gauss theorem, is to be able to formulate conservation statements. And we'll see how that works, and we'll see what can be used as a conservation, you know, what can be conserved. In general relativity, it's a fairly subtle question to consider. So I think we'll spend a little bit of time on that next time. So any questions before we stop? Okay, good. So we'll pick this up again next week.